apparently under the record. Within the state of Runnymede that said you can't make these types of solicitations or these types of commercial communications are by their nature harmful. They could pass a law which would be more restrictive than that which the federal government permitted.
If you're talking about the interstate commerce application here, the lower court seemed to pay attention to the fact that apparently under the records in the case, 25,000 email messages had to be sent to get two responses back. And the court seemed to think that that was balancing some sort of cost analysis. Well, the 25,000 messages had a cost to the recipients, and it was only producing a little bit of return to the marketing company, and so that has some sort of factor. Is that a proper analysis under the Interstate Commerce Clause?
Well, what we get into under the Pike analysis is the question of whether or not the state has a legitimate interest in regulating. So let's split that one up. First, we'll look at the cost to the residents of Runnymede. The cost to the residents of Runnymede when they get all of this spam, particularly from the petitioner, is that they have higher costs of logging in, may have long-distance phone charges. It's shifted the cost of receiving the communication from the sender to the recipient. It's as if you had protesters outside your door protesting constitutional exercise their First Amendment right to protest, but they required you to print the signs for them. Right, that's the situation that you have here. So to look at the number of communications that go to individuals within Runnymede, I think is appropriate.
NMC is not an unsophisticated individual, and clearly they're not. In fact, it seems apparent this morning they're one of the greediest, most money-grubbing parties that's ever been in this court.
I take it that's judicial notice.
But would it make a difference if it were a mom-and-pop outfit or an individual worrying about the whales or whatever?
It may in the context of whether or not they come under the definition of spam. If you look at the definition of spam in the statute, it is an electronic communication transmitted through the network or communications facilities, and it requires, I'm sorry, under Section 2 of the statute, it requires that it be done for a commercial or financial purpose. In that context...
No, that makes it unlawful. That's not the definition of spam.
No, I'm sorry.
For this definition, I've spammed my son in his school because I sent him an email that he had not given me prior authorization or permission to send him when I told him to do his homework. So I spammed him.
Well,
it just wasn't unlawful because I didn't tax him his allowance because he didn't get his homework done. But if I'd done that, then I might have been illegally spamming him.
I don't think so, although I think your son might disagree, depending on whether or not you were withholding funds. And I think the key here is whether or not the statute should be read in such a way as to require express authorization or whether under the definition of spam, implied authorization is sufficient. I receive faxes all the time from people that I've never communicated with before, and they don't violate the anti-junk fax statute because the nature of the communication and the nature of the relationship or implied relationship between me and the sender is such that there is an implied consent to receive that communication. It's not the fact that you don't like the contents of the communication, all right? For example, I'm authorized to use electronic mail. If I send you an email message that you don't like, I haven't violated the federal computer crime statute by sending you an unauthorized email or accessing your email facility without authorization because you didn't want the mail.
If I publish my email address, is that a implied permission for someone to contact me at that address?
No. It is not sufficient to create implied consent to receive any and all electronic communications. And Mr. DuBois will address the issue of the First Amendment and commercial speech.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Phil Dubois for the people and for the First Amendment. This is a case in which the party wrapping itself in the protection of the First Amendment is in fact doing more harm to that venerable paragraph than is the government. It is interesting to note that the reason that petitioner probably chose a bench trial in this matter was because of the intense public antipathy that would probably follow the jury into its deliberations. This is, make no mistake about it, commercial speech. Petitioner's overbreadth argument is about as close as they can get to a legitimate First Amendment argument. I suggest to this court that this is not political speech, this is not Save the Whales, this is none of those theoretical possibilities that petitioner throws out to try to save its own skin.
The difficulty with commercial speech is if his message said save our business, wouldn't that be political as speech as save our whales?
I guess it would depend on the content itself, Your Honor, because if it's save our business by taking advantage of this special offer, I suggest that's pretty commercial. If it's save our business because the government is indulging itself in an unbased criminal investigation and threatening to put us out of business and therefore we need donations for a legal defense fund, perhaps that's political speech. None of that happened here. This was send us money because we like it. What this is about is unsolicited commercial email, not websites, not messages to your son at college, but unsolicited, unwanted email. The court knows the three factors in determining what's commercial speech. I needn't bore the court with that. Clearly what we have here is a situation in which the government of Runnymede seeks to address the problem of the shifting of costs. They shift it to the people who receive their email, unlike junk mail. And often unlike faxes, but not completely different from faxes.
Junk mail does cost somebody, and the people that pay for it are the people who buy stamps to do their own mailing. So even junk mail transfers a cost, doesn't it?
I fully agree, and were I emperor, there wouldn't be any junk mail either. But nevertheless, we have the decisions of this court in that regard, and at least there has been, although people may disagree on the relative balances as to the cost, at least some attempt to put the cost where it belongs. In other words, the senders of that stuff pay the postage. Now, I'll grant you it increases everybody's costs because we have to have more postal workers, which in turn causes increases in emergency room work and so forth. Another of the issues that the government statute seeks to address is that of intrusion, and I haven't seen much about that from the petitioners, but the fact is that we not only have a strict free speech issue purportedly here, but we also have a privacy issue. This stuff comes into my house, comes into my office. I didn't ask anybody to come into my house or my office to try to sell me something. They just showed up. Now, it's one thing to throw a piece of junk mail unopened into the trash, but...
And his phone? They could call you.
They could. They get short shrift from me, but they could do that. The Congress and this court have dealt with that issue as well by at least requiring there be a human on the other end of it to whom one can address them.
It doesn't take very long to delete it, a piece of email.
True, but it takes time to delete it, and it also costs me money to delete it. People who telephone me don't get to make collect calls.
You heard something that sounded a bit like a least restrictive means argument, that the statute should be held unconstitutional because some tagging alternative might work. If we were to accept that as an accurate claim of facts that tagging might work, are we bound by least restrictive means principles to accept that argument?
Well, first of all, I think you oughtn't accept that argument because they don't work.
But supposing we believe that.
Well, if you believe that, then I would suggest that's still not adequate because you're still imposing a burden on somebody down the line to deal with this problem, be it at the ISP level, the server level, or be it at the ultimate recipient's level, which is where it would probably wind up. The other problem is that, frankly, the perpetrators of this practice have expended great thought and resources to evading tags, filtering software, and so forth.
Now, Counsel, is that really responsive? That goes to the cost-shifting aspects of this, but not to the least restrictive. And the question is, first of all, is that a least restrictive means?
If
it is, are we bound under First Amendment principles in commercial speech cases to strike this down because it isn't the least restrictive means?
I think not, because it is the least restrictive means. While the petitioner may argue, well, I mean, look, we just can't send any mail into this state at all, yeah, you betcha. Because there's no other way to go about it. There just simply isn't. To say, well, you must put a tag that says solicitation. Well, what's solicitation mean? You know, I mean, if now we start arguing about what's commercial speech and what isn't, and could there be some pretextual argument at the front of this solicitation that we're trying to save whales, and by the way, we have a special on garage door openers this week.
Well, it would be much less restrictive in that it would allow them to send the mails, which they claim they now cannot send because of the extraterritorial effect of the statute. So even if it's not the least restrictive, one might accept that it was a much less restrictive. And if that's the case in a commercial speech context, are we bound to rule for them?
I think not. I think that this is not political speech. This is not, well, this is simply commercial speech. That's all there is to it. It's subject to much lower levels of protection than any other kind of speech is. And I guess the short answer to Your Honor is no. The court is not bound to do that.
Suppose NMC went out and found some people in Runnymede that actually want spam and joined them in this case. They're claiming infringement on their First Amendment rights to receive this. How would the issues be affected?
Well, in that remote possibility, Your Honor, I would suggest that it doesn't change the analysis at all. It is conceivable that a pornographer could find several people in the state who are just dying to receive pornography, a child or otherwise. It's conceivable that a bank robber could find people who feel that this court oughtn't to address itself to bank robberies, but I don't care. The fact is that it's illegal, it's bad conduct, and the people of the state are entitled to prohibit it, entitled to regulate it. And
The First Amendment doesn't work that way always. I mean, the whole point of the First Amendment is sometimes even when people don't want something, they aren't entitled to regulate it. So I wonder about those analogies.
Well, regulate and receive need to be spoken of in the same paragraph here. If we were regulating content, that would be a different matter. If we were prohibiting this company from advertising the wares of its customers, that would be a different matter. But we're doing neither. We are prohibiting them from coming into my house, from coming into my office, and from making me pay for the intrusion. If there are people in the state who are just absolutely dying to be intruded upon, they are welcome to do so. I think that all they need, all this petitioner needs, is to get the consent of those people, and then they can send them all the spam that they want.
Opposing counsel has argued in his brief that there's no effective mechanism to obtain consent. Do you have a response to that?
Absolutely. That's disingenuous at best. There are many ways to obtain consent. In my view, the best way, the most protective way for the people, would be to have those who want to get it simply add their names to a database that could be easily maintained, not only by a petitioner itself, but by a central company who could make money from the people who are making money in order to know to whom to address this stuff.
Would an email request to have your name added to such a list be prohibited under this statute?
I don't think so, because, well, again, it would depend on how it's phrased. I wouldn't be very happy about getting such a message myself, but I would have a lot tougher time arguing that it violates the statute, because it is not...
12 a day?
Pardon me?
12 a day from the same source? Would that be covered by the statute?
I think it would, because at that point, not necessarily this statute, but the harassment statute, I think, would kick in at that point. I think probably, although it's a closer question, a much closer question, the petitioner could send a very brief email saying, will you give me authority to send you spam in the future? which is what Mr. Rash was referring to, and if an affirmative response is received, then they may proceed.
Would it be a less restrictive response for the statute to simply say that it would be unlawful, or rather require someone who's sending spam to discontinue that upon being notified by the recipient that they don't want to receive it? Would it be less restrictive to give them, as was suggested, one shot, you can send them this material, but you must alert them that if they notify them not to, that then any solicitation beyond that point would be unlawful, so that everybody's on notice about what the relationship is between the individual who's been receiving it and the company that's been sending it?
It would indeed be less restrictive, Your Honor. It would not be sufficient to address the state's interests. What spammers do is change their corporate names. They change the accounts, which is how they avoid the filtering and tagging software. But the fundamental problem isn't addressed. If they send me a solicitation and say, well, you can get off our list by simply replying to this message in such and such a way, or typically not replying because they use a fake return address, but by sending a message to somewhere else, get me off your list, you still got the initial problem. The message was there to begin with. Now I have to take the time and spend the money to respond to it. That's the evil that the state is addressing here. And yes, it would be less restricted to do that, but it wouldn't be enough.
You referred several times to spend the money. I was under the impression, perhaps mistaken, that most people either have free internet access or fixed price. And how does this cost, other than the time, which I understand, what's the financial cost for the recipient here?
In a word, bandwidth, Your Honor. The problem that we have is this is taking up an increasing percentage of a limited medium. Some people have the idea that the internet is sort of like broadcast media, that there's no real bandwidth restriction on it. You can just spew it out into the ether, as opposing counsel mentioned, and that's it. But in fact, it's more appropriate to think of it as a pipe, and only so much can go down the pipe at one time, and somebody has to pay for the pipe. Now, we all pay for the pipe. The backbone providers, the service providers at every level charge for the bandwidth, if you will, or the pipe that they provide. And spammers take up such a large part of it without paying for it. But that's where the real cost comes in. Yes, there's an annoyance factor. There's my time. But I am, in fact, even if I'm paying $20 for unlimited access per month, it's $20 because of the spammers. Perhaps it would be 15.
Do we have any evidence that, other than the effects on the ISP, perhaps on sending any of these things, that the size of this is anywhere close to other technologies like streaming video or real audio, or that it meets those in size in any way?
I don't think that was addressed below, so I can't really address that.
You've referred repeatedly to volume, as has your co-counsel, but the statute doesn't limit to high-volume spammers. Is there a difference between such a high-volume spammer as perhaps NMC and Lands End or Neiman Marcus or some entity that Sears wanted to send out one catalog a year?
Well, I think the statute addresses that up to a point. It makes a difference between an individual on the one hand and a corporate entity on the other. It relates to what I would consider a willfulness sort of element of the offense, if you will, regarding the degree of harm that it creates. So in that sense, the statute does address that. But if the court's asking me about the overbreadth argument again, in other words, prohibiting one person from sending one email, I think this court can easily construe the statute as, in a separate way, the court did below to avoid any problem that that might pose. And the simple fact is that that's just not what we have before us here today. Thank you.
Thank you.
On behalf of the petitioners, trying to figure out what the compelling state interests are the state of Runnymede wants to stick with in justifying this infringement and total ban on speech, it's much like trying to pin a jellyfish to a wall. On the one hand, they say they're trying to protect their ISPs in the state of Runnymede. protect them from the burden they claim is put on their ISPs from the volume of junk mail that they claim comes from our client. When pressed, counsel suggests that the real concern here is preserving bandwidth. And I ask the court to consider the implications of the state of Runnymede focusing on that justification for this statute. In essence, what they are bringing up is the concept of the scarcity of the resource. And in saying, because bandwidth is scarce, it is up to the state of Runnymede to decide what is proper content over that bandwidth. What content will this state allow over that bandwidth because it's scarce and we can't allow everything, so we have to choose among what content we think is appropriate for our citizens and what content isn't, doesn't have enough value. And we'll take the stuff that doesn't have, what we think has enough value for our citizens, and we will pass a law that says that's illegal. And that's how we will solve the scarcity problem.
Well, suppose we focus on consent instead of value. The statute, after all, makes a lot about consent. Do you accept that the state could, that there is any type of unsolicited commercial speech which could ever be regulated by a state? Or is it your position that there is no possible way for a state to regulate unsolicited commercial speech? If there is any sort, what is
our position, Justice Frumkin, our position is definitely that a state could not regulate it, probably because of the dormant commerce clause problems that would create. And I will jump to that now if that's where you want me to go, but I really would like to focus on the First Amendment implications of the compelling state interest that is now being articulated by the state of Runnymede before I get to the question of whether or not the state could do it if the federal government can do it. Because what is important to understand here is we are laying the groundwork for essentially FCC content regulation of what is permissible over the Internet. Because once you acknowledge that the government has the right to decide how the bandwidth will be used and what's permissible and what isn't because it's scarce, you lay the groundwork for the government to say unsolicited commercial email does not have sufficient value, we will not allow them to use this resource. And you lay the groundwork for them to say indecent material doesn't have sufficient value and we will not allow that to be used on our bandwidth.
But with the history of broadcast media, we've done that for years.
Exactly, Your Honor. That's how we got the FCC in the first place. But now what we're talking about is creating the justification for federal government regulation of the content of this medium that everybody up until now thought was different than the broadcast medium. We thought it was revolutionary. We thought it was going to change what free speech meant to our country because now everybody could participate instead of the people that just own broadcast.
Well, we're not asked to decide today about the scarcity or lack of scarcity. I mean, we don't have a record on that subject. So I think it's safe to say that this court would not decide that issue without further proceedings. And perhaps it might be better to sort of accept the invitation offered and focus perhaps on some of the other issues.
I will do that, Justice, especially because let's go to some of the other state interests that you try, that the state suggests. Once you try and pin one, they punt and they go to the next one. Let's talk about the burden on the ISPs in processing the email. Essentially, what this state is doing is giving an anti-competitive subsidy to these small ISPs in the state of Runnymede who do not have the ability to process the email that our client sends and other clients send, at the disadvantage of other larger ISPs in other states who do have the resources to process the email and provide it to their customers and to customers of Runnymede.
Is it your position that it's the Dormant Commerce Clause violation to subsidize everyone within the state equally in this way? What's the Dormant Commerce Clause violation there? What's the Commerce Clause violation? If that were correct, why is that a problem with the Commerce Clause?
This statute unfairly protects the small ISPs in the state of Runnymede at the disadvantage of larger ISPs outside of the state of Runnymede for the sole purpose of saying our ISPs can't handle this. So we are going to make it illegal to do what they can't handle at the disadvantage of the large ones outside. It would be similar to a statute that would be passed by a municipality or a city back in the early 1900s where you had a small phone company who couldn't handle that many calls. And so they passed a statute that says no one's allowed to speak for longer than 10 minutes on any phone call because our local phone company can't handle it. So we will we will relieve the burden on our local phone company by saying no phone calls past 10 minutes.
But saying that to the disadvantage of the larger ISPs implies that they do not want anti-spamming laws. That regardless of whether they can handle it or not, that they have different interests from the smaller ones. And
yes,
is that
ma'am.
True?
There are many states that have not outlawed unsolicited commercial email. The problem is the policy choice that has been made by those states has been preempted by the state of Runnymede. In essence, what has happened here is the state of Runnymede has taken the choice away from the individual consumer as to whether or not they want to receive unsolicited email advertising opportunities that they may be interested in. They've taken the choice away from ISPs that may want to commit the resources to their business to enable them to process these emails to their customers. They've taken the choice away from other states that may want to allow their ISPs and their customers to be able to receive this. And they have said for the entire United States, indeed potentially the entire world, no one is allowed to send unsolicited commercial email. Because the fact of the matter is, the fact that was decided by the lower court below and is a fact that is binding on this court, is that it is impossible for our client to be able to target our email to any particular jurisdiction. The only way, as a factual matter, the only way our client can comply with this state statute is to not send unsolicited commercial email anywhere in any state, regardless of the choice that is made by any individual consumers in any other state, regardless of the choice that is made by any other ISP in another state, or regardless of the choice that is made by any other state legislature.
So is that technical fact the new core argument? For example, we had a similar statute that involved leaflets, and it could have been leaflets, unsolicited commercial leaflets under people's doors. Is your argument that that would be perfectly acceptable?
I know there's case law, but yes, Your Honor, just to accelerate things, that is the essence of my argument. This is different than the junk fax statute, because the junk fax statute, you have to dial an area code. And when you dial an area code, you know where you're sending it. When you put something on someone's door, you know in what city and what state you are when you're putting it on their door. What's different about this statute is that when you send out email over the internet, you do not know where it's going. My 8-year-old daughter can send out some unsolicited financial email message to somebody else and not know where it's going. And if it happens to go to some jurisdiction where it's outlawed, like Iraq, and Iraq decides to like come and extradite my daughter and imprison her, I'm going to say, wait a minute, there's a problem here.
There's personal jurisdiction.
Well, let's talk about the impersonal jurisdiction, Your Honor. You were raising the question earlier. Yes, we do believe that there is a serious jurisdictional problem here for that same reason. There is no targeting of a particular jurisdiction. To hold in this circumstance, as Justice Enoch was talking about, where you're just shooting up an arrow in the sky and where it comes down, who knows? If you take that position that that justifies allowing the assertion of personal jurisdiction wherever the arrow lands in the context of internet speech, you are essentially saying that any 8-year-old, any 14-year-old that sends email to somebody can then be extradited and sued in some foreign jurisdiction, wherever that email ended up, even though they didn't know it was going there.
Isn't there some sort of element here of almost a willful blindfolding on the part of the archer? The clients have made no effort to find out where people are. They're very happy not knowing. It's just their purposes.
No, that's not what the record below says, Justice Kirkland. The record below says it is technologically impossible for us to target our email. It is not a conscious choice. Not a conscious choice.
You can ask people where they are.
No, that is, you can't ask people unless you first make the unsolicited email to ask them.
The state conceded that that would be acceptable under the statute. I mean,
well,
why has to go through the statute to find that acceptable? I'm not going to find that.
It doesn't say that in the statute.
But the state has apparently conceded that that would not be something they would prosecute.
When the state amends their statute and they apply the amended statute to us, we'll be here on that case. But that's not this case here, Your Honor. The statute doesn't say that.
Let me ask you a question. What possible argument can be made on behalf of a vendor who sells a product and sends out messages that, hey, I can't be sued wherever my message goes because I don't know where it goes? It seems to me that perhaps every state would have a very legitimate basis for attempting to control people who are so irresponsible as to engage in an enterprise that creates results that they don't have any way of knowing is occurring out there.
Your Honor, here.
Why should the marketing company say, we shouldn't go there And then their whole basis of their defense is, because we didn't know that's where it was going. Why shouldn't they say, if you engage in an enterprise, well, you know going into it that you have no idea what you're fixing to do. Maybe you ought to suffer the results of having to go wherever it went to defend yourself.
Your Honor, with respect to jurisdiction, the case law, I believe, requires us to have, if we are not generally present in a jurisdiction, to have specifically targeted that jurisdiction. The current technology does not allow us to decide not to do business or not to send our messages to a particular jurisdiction. We can't make the choice not to go into a particular jurisdiction because we don't know. The solution, we can be sued where we are in the United States. There is, it's not a question of an unavailable remedy. It's a question of where we're sued. More fundamentally, though, beyond the jurisdiction argument, is the Commerce Clause implications.
But all of that jurisdiction is because we don't want you to go where you didn't intend to go. The jurisdiction argument is, I'm doing business here, minding my own business, and I didn't intend for this to be over in the other side of the country. And so we say that's fair. If it did happen, then that person's got to come back to where you are to sue you. But that's different than this one. We intended to go there. We just don't know where there is. And it seems to me that if I intended to go there, then wherever there is maybe where I need to go to defend myself.
Now, there's an equivocation there because I'm not sure on what factual basis you can say we intended to go there. If my client wanted to make the decision that we didn't want to go to Runnymede, we only want to go to the other 49 states that allow unsolicited commercial email, if that is our intent, we can't effectuate that intent.
No,
technologically, it's impossible.
No, you're rearranging the argument. Your client intended it to go there.
No.
Your argument is, we intended to go there. We shouldn't get sued there. Because if we had chosen not to go there, we couldn't have arranged it that way.
Yes.
But the point is, your client intended to go there. That's why you put it on the internet. So why shouldn't you have to go wherever there is to defend yourself?
Your Honor, once you make the decision, if our only choice is whether to engage in this activity or not, and if our choice to engage in this activity means automatically that therefore we have the intent to submit ourselves to every jurisdiction in the world, all right, you have created a concept that basically eliminates the whole concept of what we have now of limited personal jurisdiction.
In this case, isn't it reasonably foreseeable when I send out this many messages that a very large number of them will come into the state?
Quite frankly, Your Honor, there's not sufficient facts in the record in order to make that probability determination. And certainly under the statute, which applies to individual messages that are sent out as well as bulk email, it certainly could be applied to an individual who had no reason to think that there was a probability to be in this state versus some other state. But in any event, if I can, I want to focus, get back to Justice Frumkin's argument or questions regarding the Dormant Commerce Clause. It is a factual matter in this case that the only way we can comply with the state of Runnymede statute is to cease the activity that our business is engaged in. Even if we want to engage solely in commerce in states where this is allowed, we are prohibited from doing so by pain of the death penalty imposed by this statute, from doing so, even by this statute, even though the activity that we want to engage in other states, that other states want to allow us to do on behalf of their citizens, this statute prevents us from doing. The lower court below was confused. It said that's not a difficult burden because it's very simple to comply with the statute. Well, the mere fact that it's simple to comply with the statute, which is for us to go out of business, doesn't mean that that isn't a total absolute burden on interstate commerce. And if I can also say, the lower court was also seriously confused on the First Amendment issue under Rowan. It suggested that the Rowan decision actually supports the state statute, when in fact the exact opposite is the case. The whole essence of Rowan was that the individual consumer, after receiving a message from a particular speaker, can make a determination that says, I don't want to receive any more communication from you. And the individual consumer, the individual citizen makes that decision, and then the post office enforces it. The court was very clear to point out two things about that. One, The individual consumer was making a decision based on the identity of the speaker. There is no legislative attempt to define what is acceptable and unacceptable speech, and therefore creates all the First Amendment problems that are inherent when the legislature tries to define what is acceptable or unacceptable speech. Instead, it's a citizen deciding who they want to receive messages from and who they don't. And you avoid, if you take the Rowan approach, all the constitutional problems that are implicated when you try and create a statute that defines what type of speech is acceptable, as opposed to who's allowed to send messages to me. The other aspect of Rowan that was key to the Supreme Court's decision was that it was the individual who made the decision, not the postmaster, not the federal government. And the court was very clear that if it had been the federal government that was in the business of deciding who would be allowed to send direct mailings to individuals and not the consumers, that would violate the First Amendment. That's what we have here. We have the state taking the choice away from individuals, taking it away from the ISPs who want to devote the resources to accommodate this, taking it away from the states, other states, that want to allow this service to their citizens. Those are choices that constitutionally under the First Amendment and under the Commerce Clause belong not to the state of Runnymede, but to the individual citizens of this country and to the ISPs to serve those citizens. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel, for your enlightenment in this difficult and interesting case. The case is submitted on the briefs and oral argument. The court is adjourned.
This completes the recording of this presentation. For information on other recordings at this conference, or other similar conferences, please contact Reliable Communications at 1-800-388-5709.